Hello, everyone. Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to welcome our next guest, Gil Zamora. Gil retired from the San Jose Police Department as a forensic sketch artist after a decorated 27-year career that saw him win multiple awards as he helped solve thousands of cases and interviewed over 3,000 eyewitnesses to crimes. His work has been featured in many outlets and on multiple shows. Perhaps most notably, his work was recognized in the Dove Real Beauty Sketches campaign of 2013, where the videos he participated in have been viewed over 100 million times worldwide. Gil's perspective, his interviewing expertise, his experience, and his relentless pursuit to improve his profession has resulted in him publishing the book, The Mindful Interview Method, Retrieving Cognitive Evidence. He is a speaker. He is a resource. He is still immersed in the world of investigative interviewing. And we are very fortunate to be able to speak with him today and learn not only how he was so successful as a forensic sketch artist, but also observation and interviewing techniques that we can apply to our daily personal and professional conversations as well. There was nowhere near enough time to get into all the questions and topics that I was hoping to. However, we had a great conversation that included how he was able to accurately turn people's observations into pictures, how he set up the room, interacted with people, and sought feedback in ways that consistently built trust and rapport throughout his interviews, his three fundamental principles for interviewing, and what I found to be fascinating, the difference between focusing on reliable information versus focusing on accurate information. It's a great interview. He has a wealth of experience, a bunch of stories mixed in. I'm really excited to share it with all of you today. And thank you so much for taking the time to join us for another episode. We appreciate you all being here. Before we jump in, of course, we want to thank our sponsors real quick. If you haven't already, please head over to humantel.com. Check out all of their best-in-class online training to recognize when people's emotions are shifting through their facial expressions and nonverbal communication. While you're there, enter the code INCLUSIVE25 for 25% off the training of your choice. Please also, for the professional interviewers, head over to certifiedinterviewer.com to get all your questions answered for the International Association of Interviewers, to join the association, and to find out all you need to know to qualify for, study, and then leverage the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation for your career. And while you're online, head over to inquasive.com. That's where you can learn more about the programs our clients ask us to customize for their senior leaders, their sales teams, their negotiators, their HR teams, and more, to teach them the strategic observation and persuasive communication techniques necessary to encourage people to share their everyday confessions in all of our high-impact conversations. As always, we appreciate you being here week after week. Thank you so very much. We've got another great episode for you today. So now, without further ado, I introduce to you Gil Zamora. Good afternoon, Gil. It is so great to see you. I really appreciate you being here today. How are you?
I'm doing great. Nice to be invited onto your show, Michael. I saw a couple of your podcasts, and I'm really looking forward to talking to your audience.
Well, I appreciate you being here. We got connected through a mutual friend, Dave Thompson. You were on his show, Truth Be Told. Dave and I worked together for years. He speaks extremely highly of you. And I really am geeked up for this conversation. Just not only your unique experience professionally, but there's so many layers to who you are and what you do that I've just found in my own research. I'm really excited to talk to you about it today.
Well, I'm really looking forward to it. And fire away, definitely.
All right, let's do it. So professionally, you were among many things, a police sketch artist. So the first question that I would love to throw out to get started is, how did turning people's words into pictures change how you listen in your conversations?
That's a great question. You know what? If you would have asked me that when I first started, I probably would have not understood exactly what you mean, but because I've learned that the information that I'm gathering from eyewitnesses is so important to the investigation, I realize how important asking the question and understanding what I'm getting back is vital to the investigation. So the one thing I can actually say that I learned is the feedback. And what I mean by that is normally interviewers, they ask people questions, they have a sort of mindset about, you know, what they're looking for. And I think we're going to get into this later, but I'm just going to move forward to say they have this mindset of what they need to get from this eyewitness. And so they just start asking questions. Many times they get in trouble because they're really not listening. The difference with my role as a forensic artist is that as I was asking questions, I was creating the illustration without them actually looking at it. So, for instance, I would ask them about the race. They would tell me about the race. I would draw an archetype of that race that I understood from all the research, all the looking at different races and so forth. So the one time that I know that I'm going to get it right is when I show them the sketch. And now they look at it and they give me that feedback to say, oh, no. Wait a minute. You need to change this or that. It doesn't look as Hispanic as I want it to. Now, that opens up another can of worms to say, well, maybe the person really wasn't Hispanic. I don't know, right? I don't know this. But what it does is it begins this narrative, this interaction between myself and the eyewitness, where we're kind of trying to come to an agreement on what it is that they believe they saw and what it is that I can actually draw to represent that. You know, what is the final? So the interesting thing about that when I think about interviewers themselves is that they don't really have that kind of feedback unless they do something like review all the information. And they go through it and they tell the eyewitness, okay, this is what I believe you said. And then they go over the information. And now when they do that, the eyewitness, hopefully, they feel empowered that they can say, no, wait, you didn't get that information right. This is actually what I said, or this is what I actually meant. So in other words, that's a way to get that feedback that I was getting all the time in my interviewers. So that was something that I really picked up and really gained some valuable knowledge about that interaction with an eyewitness.
That's a fascinating answer. And for as much as I had tried to picture, as unfair and inaccurate as I'm sure it was, what it was like to sit in that chair and do the work that you did, thinking of the fact that as you were listening and creating this composite drawing, you were doing it based on, and correct me everywhere I screw this up, you were doing it based on your interpretation of what they were saying, based against your experience and expertise on all of your research and everything you've done in the past. But the only way for you to verify how close you were to wait for the end, turn around and show it to them.
Exactly.
So it was almost like a mystery within a mystery as you were building it to then turn it around, get their verification, and then continue to make the adjustments from there.
Exactly. Now, the one thing I will make a caveat about is that this. So you're talking to me, Gil Zamora, forensic artist. If you talk to another forensic artist in another part of the country, different training and so forth, they may not say the same thing. And that's what makes our conversation a little bit different. And I want your audience to really understand that. So other forensic artists use images to help the eyewitness to recall certain features. I found out early on in my training, in my understanding of the way human memory works, is that when you introduce reference images, when you introduce anything, they call it post-event information, you can contaminate their memory. You can basically shape the way they are recalling the information. And since the artist is trying to create that image based on their memory, anytime you're introducing new information to the eyewitness, there is a possibility they're going to accept that information. Now, I was trained at the FBI back in 1993, and when I went there, what was interesting, when I was there, learn how, the rest of the country handles composite sketches, is they were introducing reference images that were based off the FBI facial catalog book. And in that catalog, they had all these images, black and white, of, eyes, noses, and so forth, that were kind of isolated so that the eyewitness could look at it. Interestingly enough, they never felt that that type of information would contaminate the memory. Now, that was early on in my career. What I had an opportunity, a unique opportunity that I will never forget, is that I actually got to meet the person that actually created that book, that created the entire training for eyewitness for composite sketches. His name was Horace Hefner. And I asked him, because at the time, at where I was working at San Jose Police Department, I was trained to not consider those reference images at the beginning of the interview, because my mentor felt that when we did that, we would be influencing the eyewitness. So I asked Horace, I said, "Horace, why are you doing that? Why are you not concerned about eyewitness memory?" And he bluntly said, "You know what? We have to train to a certain level of competency throughout the country. And you guys are doing something more advanced out at San Jose. We cannot kind of elevate that kind of training throughout the country. We have to set a lower bar so that we can get buy-in from a lot of agencies across the country." So he was well aware of the fact that they could influence the eyewitness, but they were willing to accept that their variability in actually getting a sketch that looks more like the suspect and not. Now, granted, there's going to be people in your audience who are going to go, wait a minute, Gil. I've seen these arrests that were made based on that style, that technique where they're using reference images at first. Granted, that might have happened. And there is a possibility that the eyewitness did see somebody that looked similar to those features. But there's what you're talking about, and you made it very clear, is that, look, you're trying to create that image based on the artist's experience of looking at those different types of features. And that variability of actually creating that and matching that with the eyewitness is an X factor that sometimes goes your way and sometimes doesn't go your way. And my moving forward, meaning in my career as a forensic artist, knowing full well how that information can contaminate eyewitness memory, I said to myself, I'm not going to have that as part of the variability that happens within my interviews itself. I'm saying I'm going to take that out of the equation and now just focus on what you were saying, that, okay, Gil, you're going to say, I'm going to listen to what they say. And based on my experience in understanding that racial type, my experience in looking at people, understanding how they look, what does that mean when they say he's older looking, he was angry, all those things, that is my interpretation. I'm going to say, I believe I can give the eyewitness something to look at that they can say, no, you need to change that. But it's not going to be based on some reference image that already has that information there. Because the one thing, just so your audience knows, remember, when the eyewitness is going through that and the artist tells them, hey, look through this catalog and look at all the different features and pick the ones that look like your guy. And when they do that, now the artist is looking at those reference images and drawing those reference images on the sketch that they have to see. Now, the caveat is this. The other thing, excuse me, is that what about the skill level of the artist being able to copy those features on the paper? That is where you have this different levels of proficiency going on. And how does that equate? How does that factor in what the eyewitness sees and what the actual artist can draw back? So there was too many factors there for me to cause the eyewitness to select something when it was not necessarily what they really remembered. Because here's the other thing, and to go to another question. When you're in that dynamic, and for some of your folks in the audience that know that kind of dynamic where you're interviewing somebody, you cannot deny that when that witness is in that chair, they're going to acquiesce to you. They're going to relinquish a lot of the power to you. And now add the factor that, ooh, now they're drawing something and now they're showing them, hey, what do you think? How many eyewitnesses are really going to look at that artist and go, whoa, that looks awful. That doesn't even look exactly like him. I don't know why you did this. There's not going to be many eyewitnesses that are going to stick their neck out like that and offer that kind of critique. Many times they're just going to go, okay, yeah, that looks like him. That's okay. And so forth. So that comes into question as well.
So many great points. And there's people who are listening to this. For me, I mean, I wanted to talk to you for so many reasons, and I find so much of what you do interesting. But I feel like for every human that's listening to this conversation, whether we are talking to somebody who works for us in business, whether we are talking to somebody in our family, our kids, our parents, depending on where we are in life, whether we're in business development, negotiation, investigation, at some point, you're asking somebody to recount memories, to tell a story, to connect dots for us. And during that process, we are painting pictures in our mind. We are taking the information that somebody else is giving us, and we are using that to create a new reality, a new updated understanding of the situation that we will act on from that point further. And for you as a profession, you did that in the most visceral way possible. You were putting it on paper and turning it around to somebody and basically asking them, did I listen to you? And did my brain connect with my fingers in a way to get it on the paper so it looks to you like the way you said it to me? And I'm sure you ran into situations where you wrote down exactly what you drew, exactly what somebody said, but they didn't say it the way they were thinking it. And so then we go back through all of these steps again. And I know you were a student of Geiselman and Fisher in the cognitive interview, which is, and they talk a lot about what you just mentioned, giving the control back to the person who's actually being interviewed. So they are more likely not only to be more truthful, but to cut you off and say, no, that's not right, and make those connections. So many valuable pieces that you're already talking about. I'd like to get back to this post-event evidence or post-event information. If I'm screwing up the quote, I apologize. Mm-hmm. But I think that's so important because, again, even thinking as a parent, my son is telling me a story about whatever happened at recess yesterday, or I'm talking to a client and trying to coach them through some conflict that they're experiencing, or I'm working on re-engaging with the client that maybe we're going to do something that kind of fell off and now we're getting back in. In all of these scenarios and beyond, we can inadvertently change somebody's, and I was just asked the other day about false confessions, and obviously this can play a big role in that, but that's a whole nother black hole that we can avoid at the moment. But how we introduce information to somebody can drastically change what they believe to be true or what they're willing to say at the moment. And I'm sure in your line of work, a small detail on somebody's face can make all the difference in the world in the likelihood of identifying the right person, the wrong person, never finding the right person. How did you alter your interviewing approach in order to protect against that as much as possible and feel confident that you were getting as true a recollection as the witnesses could provide you?
I think the way that I can answer that question is to have your audience understand that as I was going through my career, so we're talking 93, from 92 to 95, I was actually in training with the artist that was there at San Jose PD, Tom Macris. And during that time, that training, I sat in on 1,500 interviews. And there were anything from, you know, rape all the way to murder. So not everything in between. There was no, the only misdemeanor crime that I would often deal with might have been some fraud or some indecent exposure. Most of the time, they were all very high stress, very emotional interviews themselves, okay? But as I was going through my training, I was reading a lot about what was going on in psychology and trying to understand human memory, because I felt like, okay, I'm interviewing people about their memory. Maybe I should learn about the memory itself. And what I started finding out is that all the research they were doing focused on the eyewitness was basically saying, how can we create more accuracy from the eyewitness? And they were doing a lot of tests about that, research, experiments, and so forth. But what I started finding out as the interviewer himself and doing some post-analysis, post-analysis about the interview itself. I was a geek about that, trying to, okay, what? I would get officers telling me, the detective, hey, were they lying? What do you think? And I would go, sometimes I would give in because I thought, oh, this is fun. I'm like part of the group. And now I'm going to chime in on whether I think they're lying or not. Nothing changed. I started realizing that, okay, what if one day I wake up and I'm in a bad mood about something? I don't know. And now I interview someone. And now I'm having the bias just kind of influence my interview itself. And now I'm not getting a good vibe. And now I get the detective asking me, hey, what do you think? And now I might offer some negative insight into that interview. I felt that was not the way to go. And so what I realized is that psychologists were looking at different aspects of the interview. And they were saying, hey, these are some variables that you should be considering. For instance, estimator variables and system variables. Estimator variables about, you know, the duration of the crime, the lighting, you know, the condition of the eyewitness and so forth. You know, how they're reacting to certain things. And then the system variables is, you know, what kind of questions you're asking, how you're asking, you know, are you asking leading questions or are you not? So I started looking at that and I said, I'm going to create what I called a composite sketch analysis. I wanted to look at the interview itself and objectively go through all these variables and give a rating. And so what I started doing early on, I believe in the last probably 10 years of my interviews, is I started interviewing the people and then giving an analysis, a rating of whether the information was reliable or not. So we just mentioned something about accuracy. I'm staying away from accuracy. I'm not saying that the person is telling the truth or not. I'm saying, is the information that I can use reliable or not? And if it's not reliable, why? What can I turn to that tells me it is not reliable? That doesn't mean we're not going to use it. It just means we can measure it, decide how much are we going to invest in the information or not. So I started going through that. And what was happening is that, remember, I was getting the feedback. So the feedback I was getting is, I'm doing my interview. They tell me how it is. Yes, it looks like him. I do my post-analysis on it. I give a rating and I just put it away. A couple months later, 6 months later, who knows? Investigators get back to me. Hey, Gil, we made an arrest on that particular case. Fantastic. Send me the picture. I get the picture. I look at the sketch. Wow. Pretty amazing, right? So there's more feedback. Not only did I get feedback at the interview, but now I'm getting feedback months later about the solving of the case. But then what I was doing is then I was looking at my the analysis, the ratings that I was collecting. And what I started finding out is that certain ratings were leading to more successful identifications versus not. So it was very unscientific, but, and nobody's tested it, but what I was doing is it was allowing me to give my objective opinion and saying, I think that this sketch is reliable, this interview is reliable or not. And then they can do whatever they wanted. So I did probably close to 800, 900 cases that way. And it really gave me confidence knowing that when I did the case and I conducted my interviews and my analysis, I could then go to them with a lot of confidence and say, you can utilize this information or not. So that definitely helped. Was there something else? I think I missed something else on that question.
No, that was awesome. You had so much great stuff in there. That was fantastic. It's easy and it's almost kind of sexy to try to get drawn into that truth or lie world. Yes. And as a young investigator, clearly I was there too. But thank God I had great mentors to pull me out of that. And hearing you talk about the difference between reliability and accuracy, that is fantastic. I think for anybody listening to this, regardless of what you do professionally and who you're talking to, what's the reliability versus the potential accuracy of the information? What a better way to look at it. And yeah, you talk about the rating system that you came up with. My opinion probably means nothing on this, but it sounds scientific-ish to me. I mean, you were constantly testing and refining and testing and refining and testing and refining. And it's been a long time since I had to study the scientific method, but that checks out to me. Maybe Harvard didn't sign off on it, but that feels scientific to me. And I also would argue that you absolutely did test it because you did it throughout 900 interviews.
Yes.
And how it evolved over the course of that 900, it wasn't the same on 899 that it was on 2. So it was constantly being tested and refined. And one of the things that I'm so happy to hear, and you talked with Dave, so you know some of the guys over at WZ, it's like when I worked there and I would think I would do a good interrogation, and then I would watch the video with Dave Zaloski and leave with my ego in a trash bag. But like, now we're constantly refining our skills and not just walking away happy with the results. So the constant feedback you were getting, whether it's the iterations of the sketch, matching the actual face of the perpetrator to the sketch, updating your rating systems, that constant feedback loop. I mean, fortunate to be there, but from what I'm hearing, more fortunate that you created it for yourself. Nobody else was doing that. Nobody asked you to do that. Nobody recommended to you to do that. But you cared enough, not just about the work that you were doing, but the outcomes of the work that you were doing, that you put that system in place. So that was a fantastic answer. To circle all the way back to the beginning of it, you said something that I think is really important for people to key in on, again, no matter where they are in life and who they talk to. And that's the importance of trauma and stress during people's conversations. So trauma can be on a scale. I'm not here to judge what somebody thinks trauma is on the scale, but the trauma typically, hopefully, occurs prior to the interview. Hopefully they're not experiencing trauma during the interview. But what they are experiencing is stress during the interview. And part of that stress could be reliving or re-experiencing the trauma, being afraid of, am I being judged? Am I right? Am I not right? Can I remember? Can I not? The environment of the room, all of these things. So again, as parents, as teachers, as coaches, as leaders, we have the opportunity to adjust how we communicate with people to account for these things, to give us a better opportunity to build stronger relationships, get more reliable information, get stronger outcomes. From your experience, I got to figure out how to set up questions in less than 45 minutes. From your experience, how did you have to adjust your techniques in order to build trusting relationships that get accurate information, or excuse me, reliable information from people under stress?
Yeah. So the couple of things happened, and I wrote down trauma and stress. So, yeah, this was another thing that I did on my own. And I think it can apply to any person doing an interview itself. It doesn't have to be a forensic artist, but obviously I was doing forensic art interviewing. All the reading that I consumed about eyewitness memory said, And, you know, you referred to the cognitive interview. They also said it as well. Have your eyewitness nice and calm, if you can. Create a very, an environment that doesn't have a lot of distractions. So what I did is when I was working with my mentor, there was a lot of distractions in the office. And it was very cold, very 1950s cop decor. And when I came in 1995, I said, I'm changing that. And luckily, I was in an agency that was very forward thinking. They allowed people to kind of experiment with new ideas and weren't going to shut them down right away. So I reached out to different folks there and I said, "Hey, can I get some more comfortable furniture?" And they were like, "Sure, we have asset seizures. Let's go down there and we're going to find you some stuff." And they brought me some stuff. I added plants to my decor. I added different paintings, not showing faces. And I brought in a sound system playing soft music in the background, had a little waterfall. All that was to create a sense of calm so that when the eyewitness comes in, remember, we have to accept this. Whenever we're interviewing somebody, they already have some conceptions of what's going to happen. They have an idea. They have an idea of who you might be, how you're going to be, what the environment is going to look like, all that. My job, I felt, was to kind of jar that and make them go, "Whoa, I didn't expect this. Well, I'm going to sit in a nice, comfortable chair. There's a waterfall nearby. There's music playing. Wow, I'm getting a little more set." And then, oh, look at me. I would dress in all black. I was an officer. I could wear a gun, a badge, the whole thing, but I didn't. I felt that what was important is for them to bring them down to a level of, okay, I need to trust this person. And as I'm talking to you, I would lower my voice. I would speak a little bit softer, because I knew we were close and we were facing each other, and arranged the furniture a certain way so that they would feel comfortable. Because remember, most of the time they were speaking of awful things, very personal things, and they needed to feel like they could express themselves about anything. So that was important. Getting all that information, getting the information about how to create that calmness. And then the last part for me was my meditation practice. I knew that my wellness was important to how I was going to interact with them. And I knew that when I perform my meditation practice before my interviews, I call it a mindful reset, where I would take, you know, 5 minutes, even if I didn't have a lot of time in between, even just focusing on my breath for a minute or two right before, to kind of clear my mind about whatever it is that I might be thinking, to remember, okay, I'm here now, and I'm just going to focus on this interview itself. And this individual right here is the most important person around. And it's easy to do that, to make them feel that way when you take the time to focus. And then the other part was, why don't I just offer it to them? And what I mean by that is, you know, like we said before, they're going to acquiesce to us. They're going to give us the authority. So guess what? I'm going to take it. They see me different. They see the office. They're in that environment. I'm manipulating how they're feeling. So the last thing is, let's see some buy-in. And what I mean by that is, hey, explain to them what's going to happen. I know that eyewitness memory is a little bit difficult, but I also know that when you're calmer and you're more relaxed, you actually remember more information. I'm kind of putting that seed in there, like, oh, okay. So what I found is, if you close your eyes, kind of relax, take a deep breath, I said it helps. And here's what used to happen. When I would tell people that, I knew I had major buy-in. when the moment I said, we find, you know, and I'm just explaining this information. Hey, when we find when people close their eyes and kind of take a deep, they already had their eyes closed. They were ready. I knew that they trusted me. I knew that they were willing to go ahead and let go for, because what I told them is, it's only going to be a few minutes. I have to realize people have a life and they need to know stress that they may be dealing with when they're in there is, I have to go pick up my kid. I cannot be late. I didn't want to be here. Oh my gosh, my family doesn't know that I just went through this. How am I going to keep it away from them? All these things are happening, right? I don't know. But when we as investigators give them the respect to say, look, this is what's going to happen. We're going to do this, this, and this. They can work out the time in their head to go, okay, I'm going to relax a little bit. I know that this is what's going to happen. Got it. So that as we go through each phase, they feel very comfortable knowing, okay, Gil told me we're going to do this. He did it. Now we're moving on to the next one. Okay, we did it. Now we're going to end pretty quick. And they see that. But that buy-in of accepting the calming techniques was huge. And when they do that, stress level goes way down. And now it's about, and I'm not saying that the emotion doesn't come out. It does. But now it's in a safe environment. And I had, I would say, at least 1,000 interviews where there were tears flowing and a lot of emotion going. And I had to be prepared to deal with that as well. So the meditations that I was going through before and after were to help me as an interviewer to kind of process all that information as well. So that buy-in that they had during that interview really helped to kind of eliminate the issues of stress and trauma that might affect that interview itself.
So much genius. I love how you brought up the meditations. I would like to take an hour or some other point just to ask you about that. I don't meditate necessarily in the classic sense, but I absolutely, I'm a fan of it. I believe in it. I got to work better on getting my mind to quiet down. But there's no doubt that you putting yourself in a more calm and focused mindset, calm is contagious. Your calm became contagious to the people that you were speaking with. But what I pray that people get here, and go back and rewind it if you missed it, is the genius in small decisions, seemingly small decisions. Mm-hmm. So I can't tell you how many times, I'm sure you've seen this, that we watch a conversation and somebody walks out frustrated because they can't believe that they ended up with a negative outcome. And we're like, well, you asked the person this way at this time in front of this person standing in this stance with this tone of voice while this other thing was happening behind them. You had like a 0.7% chance of getting the truth at best. It was never going to happen. But to hear... Mm-hmm. You're making sure that there are no pictures on the wall with faces.
Right.
Because unintentionally, those faces could change how they recall the faces that you're asking them. Sitting them in more
comfort. Here's the one variable. What about my face?
Yeah.
But I'm taking that into account. I'm saying to myself, okay, that is the one thing I'm going to take into account. My facial hair and everything. I consider all of that and say to myself, okay, what are the answers I'm getting? And if they say something like, well, he kind of had eyebrows like you or a beard like you, or I'm taking that into account and saying, okay, this person didn't have a really good idea of what this other person looked like. But there is a possibility that this person does have similar characteristics as me. So if I could just add one little story, one little quick thing.
Yeah.
When I was invited to be on the Oprah Winfrey Show back in 1998, your audience can look for it. It'll be grainy video from 1998 on the Oprah Winfrey Show. But anyway, she had a show about what people remember and don't remember. It was about human memory. Fantastic stuff. And they asked three artists to come in. I was one of the three. And they gave us each an eyewitness to work with. We had no control of how they got the eyewitness and so forth. In the real world, we have detectives, police officers, you know, interviewing people and deciding, wait, this person would be a good eyewitness candidate. So let's bring him in to talk to Gil, right? So, but let's just, this was for entertainment purposes.
Mm-hmm.
My witness apparently was like 50 feet away behind the audience and really didn't have a good look of the, quote, suspect who had come in and stolen a purse. So during my interview, they told us, just do what you do. So I'm doing my interview, the whole thing. And the whole time she's in there, she's saying things like, I'm on the Oprah Winfrey show. Oh, my God. This is so amazing. I can't wait to tell my parents. They're just going to die. They love Oprah. So here's the thing. I just told your audience that most of my interviews were of serious crimes. They were people that were emotionally affected by what happened. A lot of tears going on in those interviews. Very rarely did I have an eyewitness where they were very excited and happy to be there because they were on TV, right? So this is entertainment. So what was the other thing that they did? So that's going on. They stopped my interview and they said, oh, wait a minute. I was drawing the suspect. And I had a feeling that I was drawing myself. I felt that he kind of looked like me. And so I would ask her, so did you have a sense that the person might have looked like me? And she was like, oh, no. Now, at the time, I was wearing a light beard, very light, not like yours. And so I was like drawing it very lightly. And then they call time. They bring out the eyewitness. I'm finishing up. I'm probably done, like 90% done. Now they bring the eyewitness back. And now she says, oh, he had a mustache. In the real world, I would have went, sorry, I'm not going to do it. Yeah. A, I wouldn't have let her leave the interview to come back, right? Okay, so that's for our law enforcement audience. We all know that, okay? And I keep saying, for entertainment purposes.
Sure.
So I went, all right, got it. I knew what they were trying to do. So I said, well, that's interesting. You didn't say anything before. I know, but I think he did have one. I said, okay, here's the other thing I do that's different from most interviewers. And I know that some of your audience gets into interrogations and so forth. I am not going to confront the eyewitness about a sense of not offering reliable information. I'm not going to get into that. What I will do is I will look at the information that seems to be out of the norm and then discuss with the investigative team and say, these are the reasons why this particular outcome is unreliable because this happened, right? But I'm not going to confront the eyewitness about that because I believe I'm not going to change the tone of the interview just because they're lying. Because here's the thing, we don't know whether they're actually lying or we don't know whether they're actually remembering something different or we don't know whether they're looking at, in my case, the sketch and going, oh my God, they're going to find out it's Joe and Joe knows me. Do you see what I'm saying? There's many things, and that happened actually in a case. So there's many things that can cause the person to change the way they're offering the information. My job as an interviewer is not to confront them and now turn them into a suspect. We have the time to do that later. We can do it. We can just say, all right, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. And we go on and we say, whoa, we need to look at this a little bit further because we have all this new information. So anyway, back to the Oprah show. We get out there. I add the mustache. We look at my sketch. My sketch is well drawn, you know, compared to my other colleagues. But their sketches don't have a beard, don't have a mustache. And it's a Caucasian male. So as the video rolls, my witness is next to me. We're all seated in front with Oprah, and they roll the video. And as they roll the video, I can see the suspect come in, and the suspect has no facial hair, no mustache. And my witness grabs my arm and says, I'm so sorry. So what they were trying to do in the end, when they kind of recapped it, is they were trying to say, look, the eyewitness can sometimes offer you really bad information, and it may take you down a different road on identifying a suspect. And I agree. Okay, they did that. But I also said, I think your listeners might be able to take a look at the video. I think I believe that I said something like, in the real world, I would have never made that change. I never would have done that. I would have said, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. And told the investigative team, we cannot use the sketch. We should not even publish it. So that was an interesting thing about that.
Yeah, when the entertainment factor, when they're trying, when anybody's trying to create entertainment to get the punchline that they came up in their board meeting, their strategy meetings before they ever even set the thing in motion, like it was going to happen one way or another. The what are the
Right.
odds that she was told, hey, quick, go back and tell them that they had a mustache. We need this thing to get screwed up so we can prove our point all along. But you're right. There would have been a vetting process. Is this person a good witness or not? And then moving forward. But I think there's a something outside of the entertainment aspect of that, another takeaway, and this gets back to that reliable and not reliable, non-reliable. I don't speak good English for a guy that talks a lot. But what were some of the indicators, words that people would use? So, you're recounting that story, and I hear things like, I think, maybe, might have. They don't necessarily mean that somebody's lying, especially somebody that's been in a traumatic situation. So I'm not suggesting that it means that they're lying. But from your perspective, what were some of the things that you saw that caused you to begin to question the reliability, saw or heard, that caused you to question the reliability of the information you were receiving?
Wow. That is a tough one, Michael, because I will tell you this. When I wrote my book, The Mindful Interview Method, I had to look back on the thousands of interviews that I've done. And for my book, I looked at several hundred videos and audio transcripts to understand why was it that my technique was able to gather reliable information. I'm going to get to the answer. That journey of trying to figure out how I did that got me to understand that, wow, I was working, and like I said, at the time I didn't know, but looking back and trying to create this book that helps other people interview, understand how to interview somebody. Going through that process made me understand that, wow, I was actually interviewing these people with certain principles in mind. And the three principles that I focused on were that I respected the eyewitness, I adhered to what I call tiati, which means that is all there is, and three, limiting my suggested questions. Now, respecting the eyewitness, what does that mean? It can mean a lot of things. And here's the thing. Here's the thing. When I'm respecting the eyewitness, I'm respecting that their memory may not be great, that they may not necessarily be lying, that they may not understand my questions, and that I might have to rephrase it in a way that they do understand. There's a possibility that I may not understanding their response. So it's on me. So that's where the respect comes in. The tiati, that's all there is when I ask a question and they give a response, what is my next question? And what I mean by that, here's a simple example. Hey, tell me about his hair. And they go, I don't know. It was just short, just normal. I'm saying to myself, another interviewer might go, well, I need to know exactly what that means. So there's many ways you can go. The way I would go is, well, can you tell me a little bit more? I still leave it open to them because I want to know, is this it? Is this all there is? Meaning, is that all they really remember? Because remember, if we put the memory of whatever happened in context, there's a possibility that they didn't see that particular detail because that was not important in the big scheme of things. We don't know. But why should, and to my friends that that rely on the cognitive interview, and I know that most of the cognitive interview ideas and the concepts say, hey, the eyewitness saw it. They know everything. It's there. It's just the way that you ask the questions. And I, you know, I started with that methodology, but I feel that they're in the wrong hands, in interviewers that are not as experienced, could be very dangerous. Because what it happens is that they feel like, well, they were there, they saw everything, then they must know. I just need to make sure I ask the question so that I get that information. An experienced interviewer might correct you and say, there's a possibility they didn't remember that. It's okay. You can move on. So Tiati kind of allows the interviewer to go, okay, ask your open-ended question. Whatever they give you back, getting back to our hair, well, it was just, you know, just kind of short. I don't really remember much. If my next question after, that's my second now, I've asked already about the hair. They said, okay, it's just normal, short. And then I ask another one, tell me more. And now they go, well, it was just kind of short. I really don't remember much. If my next question is, well, was it like a buzz cut or was it like a Caesar cut? Now you're doing dangerous things. Because remember, we have already said that they are going to relinquish a lot of power to you. The moment you start suggesting, now the third question, they're going to go, ooh, they want something. I'm going to, okay, I can go with that. Yeah, he had like a Caesar cut. I'm okay with that. Now, is it really what they said? No, it isn't. But no one knows that because it's already given, right? So, and that goes along with the limiting suggested questions. Sometimes that's going to happen in interview. That's okay. As long as you're mindful as an interviewer, knowing I just asked a leading question there. I need to back off of that. Because sometimes we're faced with an eyewitness that doesn't understand the question. English may not be their first language and they need some help. Hey, tell me about his race. They go, I don't know. What do you mean? And then you go, well, I'm talking about, you know, is he white, Mexican, Filipino, you know, Chinese, whatever. Now you're giving them, that is a leading question we're asking, right? But we know we're doing that. We're doing that because they didn't understand our question. They don't understand that. And in the scheme of things, in our interview itself, we can now say to ourselves, okay, they're going to need a little more assistance because of their lack of understanding, but we're factoring that in. So I realized that I was adhering to those principles throughout. And when I did that, I was able to gather more reliable information because I always knew, okay, don't ask that type of question right now. That's it. They don't know anymore. If you cross that line and ask a little bit more, you are now kind of manipulating their answer, and that information that you just gathered is really not that reliable. And I was being honest with myself, and I kept saying, no, I need to not do that, because I accept the fact, if I've read all the information, the research about human memory, and they say it's unreliable and can be adjusted and changed, well, then I have to accept that. And it's true. And I know after thousands of interviews, I know that's true, because I know in that interview setting, I can change their responses if I wanted to. We have that kind of power. All your interviewers know, they've been in there, the veterans know that they can kind of tweak it just enough to make them go, okay, yeah, that's what I saw. So,
and I don't know that people realize how strong that power is. I'm going to assume that most people are going to do it unintentionally, unknowingly, unwittingly, subconsciously. Like, they're not making an effort to try to change somebody's memories. But that power is significant. And it's significant in how we can change it in the moment. It's significant on what we can cause people to change that they believe that they actually saw, heard, experienced, and then the impact that it has on the outcome. All of those things are super important. And with your, that's all there is. Again, to take it back to so many conversations outside of interviewing, in your example, again, I've never done a composite sketch in my life. If I did, probably look a lot like a stick figure. So I stayed out of that career for many reasons. But if somebody says it was just short and normal, if you draw a short normal haircut and you spin it around and say, ah, the hair's not really right, there's opportunities to correct it later. There's no need to force it now. As parents, exactly. As leaders, as coaches, as business development negotiators, we get, that's all there is for now. That doesn't mean that's all there's ever going to be. We can get that now. And to your point, that's enough to keep the process moving forward. And there'll be other opportunities to add, to edit, to adjust, to update as we go through the conversations.
That's a good point. If I may, in the mindful interview method, I go through what I call investigative framework, where I say, look, you're going to go through all these topics. A welcome, suspect, description, crime elements, confirmation of details, and a closing. When you know that you're going to go through all these topics, if the eyewitness starts talking about another topic outside of where you're at, you have the confidence to know, I'm going to go back there again anyway. So it's okay. I'm going to let them say whatever they want. Many times I'd have an eyewitness, hey, tell me. So my first question in my welcome topic area is obviously, you know, the whole rapport building and hi, how you doing? What's going on? I always ask, do you know why you're here? The reason I ask that question, I want to know their mindset. I want to have a glimpse into what it is that we're thinking, what they were assuming was going to happen here. And many times I would get answers like, I don't know why I'm here. I told the officer I didn't see anything. I don't know why I'm here. Okay, if you can just imagine yourself, you're going to interview somebody and they're telling you, I don't know what the fuck that guy told me, but here I am. So right off the bat, you've got some apprehension from that person. You've got some, like, I don't think you guys know what you're doing. So my job is to kind of say, it's okay. I want them to feel empowered. And I say, all right, well, something happened to you, right? They go, yes. Well, there's a possibility that they believe that you saw something. I'm going to tell you this. Remember, I'm trying to get them to have a lot of trust in me. I'm going to say something like, well, Here's the issue here. So I'm here to interview you about what you saw. If you really didn't see anybody, it's okay. I have the power to just say, thank you very much, and you move on. We don't have to interview you. So this could be a quick 3-minute interview, or it could be a half an hour. It's up to you. And now you sense them kind of like, oh, okay. So and then I go, let me just tell you, can you just tell me what happened? And then they go on with their story. And in that story, I get a sense that, well, I think they did see something. So then I'll stop them. I'll go, okay, well, you know, at this point, it sounds like you saw something. And they'll go, well, okay, yeah, I did, but I don't think I saw it. Here's the thing. What they don't know is, how are the questions going to come out? What is important for us versus what they think is important? And so when you kind of explain it that way, many times they go, oh, okay, but here's the thing. How am I treating them? With respect. I understand. I'm explaining. So now they go, okay. Remember, that's all part of rapport building. From the moment we meet them to the end of the interview, we should be thinking about rapport the whole time, right? So we get to move forward from that. If I may, because this has something to do with what you were talking about. You were talking about stick figures and drawing, right? A lot of times over my career, other detectives would come up to me and go, hey, Gil, did you see that sketch on national TV? That looked like a cartoon. They're never going to catch that guy. What I would always say is, I'm not worried about the outcome of that sketch. What I'm more concerned about is how did they ask questions? That's what I'm concerned about. Because here's the thing. There are artists that can draw really well, and there are artists that cannot. But my concern for the investigation is, how did you come up with that information? Because their crude drawing in different hands could look much better. But the questions that they ask are at the essence of, did you get reliable information or not? And that was always the kind of pushback I always gave to investigators to say, hey, hang on. You should be more concerned about how they asked those questions and what those questions were, not the outcome. So anyway, I just wanted to touch on that before we got too far gone.
No, I love it. Thank you for bringing it up. And I can't, from a different perspective, obviously, I can't agree more that the quality of the questions and everything you talked about, from how you set up the room to the tone of voice to the actual phrasing of the questions, the order of the questions, everything you've talked about today, that all has a significant impact on the quality and reliability of the information that we get. And as interviewers, mm-hmm. as interviewers, parent talking to kid, manager talking mm-hmm. to employee, customer development talking to customer, it doesn't make a difference. If you're trying to get information from somebody and we're frustrated that we're not getting the quality information, the first place to look is back at us. Is what are we exactly. doing that's making this more difficult than it needs to be? And I'm here taking notes, learning from you throughout this conversation. And I'm excited to read your book. I must confess, I meant to read the whole thing before our conversation. I have not finished it yet, but I'm excited to get through it. And even as I learn from you, I'm thrilled to at least be in sync principally with a lot of the things that mm-hmm. you do, because I have a young son, he's in elementary school. We talk to other parents and they're like, well, how come Gabe told you all this stuff and our kids didn't tell us?
There you go.
Yeah. Some of it might be the kid and how they think and how they process and all that stuff. But I'm willing to bet you sat across the kitchen table from your son and acted like it was the primetime episode of Law and Order. And my wife and I, when Gabe says, I don't remember, we say, okay. And we change the subject a little bit and then we come back to it. And then next thing you know, maybe it took 20 minutes, but now he's giving us all of these details and it's reliable. And when we chuck it against what other people say, this is within a reasonable degree of variation. This is almost certainly what has happened. I would love to keep talking to you for another 2 hours. There's topics we haven't even got to yet, but I have to be respectful of your time and all the other things you have to do today besides talk to me.
Right.
You mentioned your book, The Mindful Interview Method, Cognitive Evidence is what you call it, right?
Right. Yes.
Which hopefully we can do this again and I can get into some of the other topics that I would love to talk about. But as we wrap this up today, you've already mentioned it a few times, but I'll be grateful if you could please explain to the audience what they can learn from that book and then where they can connect with you in order to continue to learn from you and your experience.
Yeah. So one major part of the book, when I was talking to my editor when I was writing it, was that it was important for me to explain why the assessment was important. So what I mean by that is, remember, I had to reflect on my interview process and look at, at least 1,000 interviews that I did. At the time, I was recording these interviews, audio recordings, video, didn't matter. And I was holding it for training purposes. I was holding it for in case I ever went to court. And it was just a way for me to kind of keep track of how I'm doing things. And I just put them away. Didn't even worry about it. Because remember, unless I was going to court, I would go, oh, okay, I can go look at it to see what I did or said. I had the sketch as an example. But if I wanted some insight about that interview, I could look at it. When I retired, all that came with me and I have it. When you listen to them again, what you realize is, wow, you don't even know who the person is. You don't know what the crime is. You don't know anything other than if I said something like today's date, 1996 or 97, whatever it said. Most of the time you had no idea what was going on and you didn't know who the witness was or the victim other than you heard a voice. So when I started transcribing all that information for the book, I started to try to figure out how can I say that this information is reliable versus not? And I had to compare my interview technique with others. And so I went around looking for different transcripts, and I was fortunate enough to reach out to this producer that was doing a podcast on a local PBS station about these interviews that had gone wrong in the agency. I won't bore you with that information, other than when I reached out to them, I didn't know what was going to happen. They checked with their lawyers and they said, sure, we'll send you everything. And they sent me all these interviews. And I was able to compare and contrast that with my interviews itself. And I was able to put the assessment tool that I created to say whether this is reliable or not on those interviews. And a lot of the book has to do with that, meaning this is why I think that question is unreliable or not. This is why I think you should do this or not, because of the history and the research on it by psychologists, and then my own experience from that, right? I also show transcripts where people, veteran investigators, novice investigators, can look at and go, would I've asked that question? Wow, I normally ask that question. I didn't realize, now thinking about it, whether that was actually not a good question or not. But they can now see it for themselves. And now they can look at it and say, I know why Gil says that information is unreliable versus reliable. So the book does a lot about that. And it gives you scripts on how I was interviewing people under normal circumstances, and gives you some ideas on what to consider in different circumstances. So that's really what the book is about. It's heavy on theories and concepts, and definitely even more heavy on the examples in the transcripts themselves, where I actually go in and tell you, look, I think what I just asked here is this type of question. And you can go back to why am I, it's not me that's saying that this is that type of question. I've done my research with these other folks, you know, cognitive interview, the conversation management approach that they're handling over in UK. Mm-hmm. And I've said, look, they've said the same thing. So I didn't know when I was writing my book that I was asking these type of questions. And there was this one thing that I learned where I was doing what I was calling a mirror echo words. I would say echo words. Turns out when I was doing my research that this author, his name, he's an FBI interrogation specialist, Voss. He was saying the same thing. But remember, we're saying the same things, but in different contexts. Mm-hmm. And I was saying, wow, I'm using that technique also to kind of keep the eyewitness in that area. What I mean by that is it's a way for you as an interviewer to keep somebody in that topic, in that specific area of conversation, to see if there's something else there, instead of saying, hey, go ahead. You're telling me what's going on here. And they said, yeah. And then I went to the parking lot. I parked there. I saw this car there. And then I went up to the ATM and so forth. And instead of letting them go through that whole thing and then going back and go, hey, wait a minute. You talked about that car. Tell me more about that car. Why not just offer the mirror probe, that way of echoing what they just said? So if you're really listening really well, and you're in a very synchronous way, a symbiotic relationship, you should be able to drop in that mirror probe, and it does not affect them negatively. And what I mean by that is, so going back to that description, yeah, so I went into the parking lot. I normally don't go to this bank, and then I drove by and I see this car there. This car, that slows them down to go, yeah, Yeah, this car, you know, I did notice that car. It was kind of funny. There was a guy inside and looked like he was smoking, and that gave me new information. Because as an investigator, right, you know, I'm talking to the cops out there. They're thinking, oh, he's smoking, DNA, maybe that's something at the parking lot. Where is he at? I'm gonna look at video, the parking lot, what's going on in that parking lot? What car is there? Can we see all that from that one little statement? Do we need to now tell the eyewitness, wait a minute, wait a minute. Can you tell me the license plate on that car? Can you tell me the make and no, we don't. We can just let them talk. But the mirror probe allows them to kind of give us more information if there is. So, for instance, another example would be if I asked about the same car and I said, the car, and they go, yeah, you know, I really didn't see much. It was just there. I don't know. Well, that's different. Now I know they don't have any. So I let it go, right? So the book is a lot about that, giving you examples about the mirror probes, about asking certain questions, how to answer it, and so forth, with scripts involved as well. So, and you can find all that information at mindfulinterviews.com, www.mindfulinterviews.com. The last bit I will tell you, I'm working with different agencies right now. I'm all about the assessment. And what I mean by that is I believe that we're not looking at how we're conducting these interviews, these eyewitness interviews with people, because the only time we're looking at them is when something bad happens, meaning an innocent person gets arrested, and now they find out later they're trying to petition the court to say, I didn't do it. Please get me out of here. And then somebody actually looks at the transcripts of different interviews that were done early on, that were done in very obscure situations where nobody thought anything, nobody was looking. And then they see, wow, that information there led to this ID, led to this arrest. And it turns into, well, that information there was unreliable, but they don't know it until they go back. And then that's the moment where they say, wow, we should have never asked that question. Why are we doing that? And my big soapbox is to say that the federal agencies have long been coming out with information telling people this is the way you should interview people. This is based on science. This is based on research. You should do this. But because all of our agencies are decentralized, it is very difficult to have the actual agency adopt these national standards because everybody's doing it their own way. And that's just the way it is. And I'm sure it happens in private industry when they're doing interviews themselves. Hey, this is the way we do it, and we're successful. Until, and I'm sure some of your supervisors are out there going, yeah, he's right. Until somebody screws up, and now we're paying a lot of money. And now we have to change our policy. That's when things start to change. And people start to say, wait, why are we doing it that way? So, a part of my book is about the assessment process. And I'm trying to reach out to different agencies to say, let's look at how you are doing your interviews. Let's find out how your interviewers, your interview practitioners, as I call them, how they're conducting the gathering of intelligence, gathering of information. How are they doing? Are you willing to allow that transcript to be analyzed objectively and just to come out and say, hey, what are we doing? We don't need to point fingers. We just need to go, how well are you doing? And then if you're not doing well, why not consider a more structured interview format where you're adhering to certain principles? They could be the principles that I'm talking about. But if you're not, then you need to ask yourself, why aren't you adhering to principles? And how are you implementing them? So that's basically the whole read on the mindful interview method. And I hope your audience is able to get a copy and read all about it. It's a boring read, but it's a lot of good information.
Actionable. It's an actionable read. There's things that we can turn
Yes.
around and start applying in all of our conversations. It might not read like an Oprah scripted entertainment
Right.
documentary, but it's actionable. Yes. Everything in there is meant to be put into action. So I'll make sure I've got the links. And I appreciate even what you said at the end, because it's not always, we've got to separate the process from the results. And it's not even that somebody screwed up. And I can say this firsthand for any number of things in my life. I don't necessarily know I've been screwing up if my screw up still yields something that I consider success. It's only when it yields something that consider success. I've been screwing this up the whole time and just getting lucky to some degree and or being ignorant of it. So great. Gil,
those are the heuristics of investigative interviewing. That's what that is. So, you know.
Yeah. I can't thank you enough for your time today. I appreciate it. Thank you so much. We had to reschedule to get this done. Thank you for staying with me. I really appreciate it. I'm grateful for all that you shared. And I'm serious. I would love down the road to schedule a round two if you're open to it and get into any number of topics that we didn't have the time to today.
I would love to, Michael. And I look forward to seeing you again. And good luck with the program. And I hope if anybody has any questions that they want to forward to you or so forth, I'm willing to answer. Okay? Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care. Have a great weekend. We'll see you soon. Gil, thank you so much for a great conversation. I felt like I could have gone on for at least another hour. There was so much there to work with. I really appreciate all that you shared, and I appreciate your dedication to your craft and the way that you can continue to help us all learn and benefit from it. I love how you talked about the importance of feedback, being able to turn the picture around, work through the picture, understand how accurate your observations are, how you're able to turn their thoughts into a picture of somebody else's face. That was fascinating to talk through. I also love the constant iteration of your work, going back and listening to the transcripts, comparing the sketch to the suspect, going back through the whole interviews. That was fascinating and another shining example on how we can all consistently develop and fine-tune our craft. I also didn't want to skip over the role that meditation plays in all of this, how you can center yourself to stay calm in what had to be emotional conversations to sit through to help somebody else stay calm. And your philosophy of that's all there is, we'll move on. If that's all there is for this answer, we'll move on. We'll continue the conversation. We'll keep going. I think that's a great philosophy that it can help us in so many ways in our business and investigations and our family and beyond. That was a fantastic conversation, Gil. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to hopefully talking with you again soon. And as always, thank you to everybody that shared another hour with us today. Hopefully you all took notes and have a new perspective on how we can connect with people based on how we speak with them, the questions we ask and avoid, how we set up the room and the context of the situation, how we internalize and react. So many lessons in that conversation that we can all apply. Thank you for being here. Please, before you go, take a second, like the show, share the show, leave our feedback, subscribe. All of these things really make a difference. We appreciate your continued support and let us know your feedback. Who else would you like to see? What other topics would you like to see and hear from us? Thank you so much for being here. And before we go, let's shout out our sponsors one more time, HumanTel. If you haven't already, head over to humantel.com. They've got the best in class online training to teach yourself how to identify when people's emotions are shifting by accurately interpreting their facial expressions and nonverbal communication. While you're there, enter the code inquisive 25 for 25% off of their online training. For the professional interviewer, certifiedinterviewer.com is the place to go for all of the answers you need on joining the International Association of Interviewers, as well as the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation, what that can mean for your career and how you can get involved today. That's all over at certifiedinterviewer.com. And while you're online, please head over to inquisive.com to learn more about the customized sessions our clients ask us to facilitate for their senior leaders, sales teams, HR teams, and more, to teach them how to encourage people to share sensitive information under vulnerable circumstances in the face of consequences. All that and more at inquisive.com. Thank you all so much for being here another week. We truly appreciate all your time. Stay safe, take care of each other, and we'll see you next week. Thank you.